This is an ABC podcast.
Hello and welcome to the Insiders Back to You podcast. I'm David Spears and I'm joining you from the lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation in Melbourne. PM presenter David Lipson joins us from Gadigal country in Sydney, and ABC political reporter Melissa Clark is on Ngunnawal country in Canberra. Welcome to you both.
Thank you.
Hey Mel, hey Spearsy.
Now, Parliament has wrapped up for the year just, two or three hours ago. In fact, they had to sit on a Friday morning, unusually, to pass the last of the government's busy legislative agenda in this final week for the year. There was the IR bill that went through the House this morning after going through the Senate last night. This week also saw the National Anti-Corruption Commission passed into law, territory rights legislation. There was a decision by the National Party to oppose the Indigenous Voice to Parliament, and of course, a censure motion of former Prime Minister Scott Morrison over his secret ministry. So, lots of fodder for some great listener questions this week.
Quiet week, as always.
Indeed. They used to call it the killing season. It wasn't quite as busy as some of those years were when they necked leaders in the final week, but they just got on with a lot of business. Let's start with a question from Jenny, though, who asks about the Morrison ministries. Jenny says, how is it that the Liberal Party can consider not supporting a censure motion when it seems there's no doubt Scott Morrison acted in an unexplained and astounding manner when he appointed himself secretly to those ministries? Look, Mel, one Liberal, Bridget Archer, did cross the floor to support the censure motion. Karen Andrews also abstained. But, Mel, why did the rest of the Liberals refuse to support this censure motion?
Look, effectively, the opposition's rationale here was that they didn't think it was a necessary step. Most Liberals agreed that Morrison did the wrong thing in appointing himself to those extra ministries, but mounted the argument that it having been uncovered, it having been looked at in two inquiries, that there being agreement to address this in ways to ensure that it can't happen again, that was sufficient, and that Labor was only pursuing this censure motion as a political means to take a whack at the coalition. But it did lead to a fairly incongruous vision of having the opposition have to defend the man whilst condemning the conduct, and then, you know, many of them going up to Scott Morrison afterwards to, you know, shake his hand or give him a pat on the shoulder as a bit of a show of support for him, does really make it quite hard from the public's point of view to understand how it is that they condemn the action but nonetheless seem to be backing him in. It certainly left them in an awkward political position.
It did look awkward. David, what did you think? I mean, I guess on a human level, they want to help someone who's, you know, clearly would be going through a tough moment, but it was awkward, wasn't it? And a little embarrassing for the Liberals.
Yeah, look, I think that's right. I think it was awkward and it was embarrassing. But I also don't know if it was sort of black and white for them because, yes, behind the scenes, as Mel said, they hate what he did. But they also look to Scott Morrison as someone who saved them in 2019 from the election they were expected to lose. And to support a censure motion, I think, would in many ways kind of undermine or undo the things that he did do in government and kind of, you know, he would really go down in history for that moment, not to the same level as Richard Nixon in the US, but there'd be an element of that potentially. And you know, no one remembers that Richard Nixon, for example, ended the draft or ended assimilation for Native Americans, that sort of thing. They remember him for Watergate. Now, look, it's a very different scale. I'm not saying it's the same thing here, but I think there was probably a bit of anxiety about going that hard on him. So they were in an awkward position. And look, the other thing is this element of, as the Liberals, the opposition claims it as sort of revenge by Labor. I think that, you know, potentially there'd be voters out there that would not have been as in favour of a censure motion as you could imagine, because I think what voters really like to see is governments getting on with the job, doing the things they said they would do, which the Albanese government has done, as you mentioned, a whole lot of. I think they're less keen on these sort of political plays. So look,
they're going to have to move on from this now, right? I mean, they can't keep dwelling on the Scott Morrison ministry.
They'd have to, surely. But this is the other thing, though. I mean, I think it was important with Scott Morrison still denying that he'd done any of the things that a lot of people say he did do. You know, and look, a lot of his claims are a bit smelly too, right?
What do you make of his speech, of his defence? I mean, he mounted a really solid defence of his time in government, but just this little bit that they were actually debating, the secret ministries, the defence that he gave on that wasn't amazing.
It wasn't a particularly cogent defence. It's one thing to say that he bore an enormous pressure of being a leader at this sort of globally unprecedented times with the unknowns of COVID coming down, but it doesn't address the very obvious questions of how that related to some of the five portfolios that he overtook, the timing of it, given that there were other ways.
What did Pep 11 have to do with COVID?
Exactly. So whilst it was a wholeheartedly given defence, it seemed, I don't think it really addressed the very logical questions that had been put to him.
There were some huge holes in the stories the way he was presenting it, you know, and a lot of them have been raised, you know. The former High Court Judge Virginia Bell took issue with some of what Scott Morrison was selling on this, but even just the simple proposition that he thought his office had told the finance minister, but then what he never got it as much as a text message from the minister or a comment as to, oh yeah, hey, I heard that you took over my portfolio. Yeah,
all good.
Carriage of it. Did he ever think that was weird? I mean,
and the idea that it wasn't his intention for it to be secret. If only one of us had thought to ask, he would have told us all about these ministries. I mean, really. That was a little laughable. Let's move on, though, to the voice to Parliament, because we've got a couple of questions here. Rex asks, what is the real reason the National Party this week came out against the voice? Well, there's a few reasons to consider here. Pressure had been building on David Littleproud internally. Some in his ranks genuinely do not support the idea of a voice to Parliament on the grounds that it would divide Australians by having a body uniquely representing only Indigenous Australians. That's their view. Jacinta Nampinjimpa Price, the senator from the Northern Territory, has been arguing this case very strongly for a while. Some of the arguments put forward by the Nats, though, don't really stand up very well. One that David Littleproud has made, that it would be a body for elites in the big city rather than remote and regional areas. I mean, when you look at what's actually proposed here, it would actually have greater representation from those remote and regional areas than the urban areas. He also argued that it would do nothing to close the gap.
Unfortunately, we've got to a position where we don't believe that this will genuinely close the gap. So the National Party has made a position that we will not support the voice to Parliament.
As if the current arrangements are achieving much on that front. They're clearly not. And he even mounted a concern that the voice would emulate ATSIC in some ways. And again, it's quite clearly designed very differently to ATSIC. It would not allocate funds. It would not administer programs. It would simply advise. Mel, what do you think here, though, to Rex's question, the real reasons why the National Party did this week?
Yeah, this is a really tricky one to answer, and I don't think we have the definitive answer yet. You are absolutely right to say that David Littleproud is under internal pressure on this issue, and Jacinta Nampinjimpa Price has been central to that. It seems that she wants the Nationals to plant their flag in the ground before the end of the year, and you know, this week being the last week they had a chance to gather as a party room was the time to do that, if that was the time frame that she or others in the party who support her view are insisting upon. It does create a very interesting dynamic now in the joint party room with the Liberals. It now makes it quite awkward for Peter Dutton, almost impossible to get the Liberal Party or the, well, obviously it's impossible now for the coalition as a whole to be voting or campaigning in the yes side. It makes it very hard for the Liberals alone to campaign on the yes side when there are many who do not support the voice and now see their coalition partners openly suggesting that no is the answer Australians should be voting on in this regard. So I think it's an interesting power dynamic going on here between David Littleproud and Peter Dutton. And it certainly seems that many of the Liberals were caught by surprise on this. I'm not sure about Peter Dutton, but it certainly seems that this was a unilateral move.
So, yeah, I understand there was no discussion in the shadow cabinet, no discussion in the shadow leadership group. He did get, David Littleproud gave Peter Dutton a heads up in a quick phone call before the press conference, but that was it. So some of the leadership group are a bit annoyed at that there wasn't more discussion about where this would leave the coalition. There is a view, though, that the messiness for the Nats this week, David, by which I mean, you know, they announced this position, then you had one of them, Andrew Gee, saying, well, hang on, I disagree, I'm going to back the voice. Another one, Sam Birrell, saying, well, I'm reserving my position. Another one, Michael McCormack, saying, yeah, we might actually change our position down the track on this. It was all a bit weird. That means Peter Dutton, who knows there are different views in his ranks, won't want to do the same thing, that he'll let them have a free vote on this so they can make up their own minds. Well, what do you think?
Yeah, look, I think that's very likely. I think it would be fairly dangerous for Peter Dutton to come out with a firm position, particularly a firm against position, considering the losses that the coalition had in inner city, you know, urban seats to the Teals and you know, some of those more moderate candidates. But, you know, I think Mel's right. We don't know the full reasons for the Nats to take this position at this time and do it in such a messy way when it clearly, you know, hadn't been fully canvassed and discussed with the party room. I think there's an element of kind of classic Nationals ideology of, you know, country grassroots folks versus the elites from the city, and the way that Littleproud framed one of the reasons that he was opposed to a voice, I think, you know, goes to some of the politics of this.
It's a bit of a straw man argument, though, isn't it? That idea that this is for the urban elites, for Redfern, not the remote areas.
100%, but it doesn't stop them from kind of making that kind of classic Nationals argument, I guess, you know, that the sort of the shift that we've seen, that it's all around the world, that it's kind of the globalists living in the city and the workers living out in the bush. Now, you know, think what you like about that argument. It is one that is very regularly made. The other thing I think that was kind of noteworthy and pretty disappointing, really, was just how quickly this descended into personal insults. And perhaps, you know, it gives us a bit of an indication of how problematic this debate could be and how potentially traumatic for Indigenous people it could be in the months ahead. I mean, you think back to the same-sex marriage debate, which was very ugly. I mean, this could be and you know, very much like that or worse. So I did note that Linda Burney, the Minister for Indigenous Australians, did not engage in those personal sort of insults and in fact gave a pretty powerful speech to the Parliament, making clear that she wasn't going to go down that path. And let's just hope that we see more of that in the months ahead.
I think it's a good point. Yeah, no, exactly. The tone will matter a great deal here. Good question, Rex. We've got another one on this from Hossam, who says, what guarantees will be there that the Parliament will seriously consider the voice, regardless of who's in majority, and allocate time to publicly debate it? Look, it's a good question, Mel. There really aren't any guarantees, are there, about what happens?
Yes, this is... Well, this is the thing about Parliament. It's interesting because we often, and I think the media here often are also asking for guarantees, but there are very few guarantees in politics, let alone in Parliament. There is a sense of taking people at their word. I think the fact that the Labor Party has made such a significant public commitment to advancing the voice, in that I think that's as good a guarantee as you're going to get that they will seriously pursue legislation following a referendum, should it be successful, about having a voice in place. I don't think there's too much doubt about that. If there were some circumstances that may lead to some delay, God forbid we have another global pandemic or something that seriously disrupts how we operate, then of course those things may happen. So I think it is very hard to give a guarantee. But I think the public positioning from the Labor Party would be near on impossible to walk back from. And I think from what we've seen from Anthony Albanese as Prime Minister, both publicly and privately, this is a position that he holds dear and believes is a serious part of what he wants to contribute to political life in his time as Prime Minister. So I think there is a personal element to pursuing this from the Prime Minister as well. And I think that's about as much of a guarantee as you're going to get.
He said it in his election night victory speech, front and centre. He made this clearly a point of that victory speech. And I think that tells us more than anything how important this is to him. You'd be on the back of a successful referendum. Of course, you'd want to capitalise on that and get it done through Parliament pretty quickly. Same thing happened with the same-sex marriage postal survey. As soon as the overwhelming results were clear, they got in and got it done pretty quickly. The other question here too, David, is before then, in the lead up to the referendum, how much detail should the government be putting out there? This at the moment, and it's a bit of a, I can sort of see both arguments here. At the moment, their approach is keep the detail very minimal. We'll deal with that after the election. We want Australians voting on the principle of this, not the detail of this. There's goodwill around fixing this problem in Australia. This is the proposal to do it. You put detail out there, it's going to get picked apart by different groups. But the flip side to that is, you know, do Australians need to know a bit more about what they're voting for?
Yeah, well, it's very easy to run a no case on if you don't understand it, vote no, or if you don't have the detail, vote no. So, look, I think that is a fairly dangerous proposition, but there are certainly supporters of The Voice who have very differing views on this. You know, they see both sides, as you do, David. You know, Anthony Albanese, yes, clearly a very, very strong supporter of this, but very interesting as well that he has taken this hands-off approach. He kind of wants the public to lead the debate. But we really haven't seen, I'd have to say, much of the sort of yes camp leading the debate. You know, where have they been? It really has been fairly quiet ever since Anthony Albanese put forward those three sentences at the Garma Festival that he thinks should be added to the Constitution. The debate's been fairly subdued until this week when the no case put forward by that the Nats kind of exploded on the scene. And I think, you know, now the yes camp really has to sort of get their act together. Now, whether that's, you know, community advocates or politicians, regardless, they've got to sort of start to drive this forward once again.
No, I think that's right. And presumably that starts up next year. And look, for anyone screaming, there's plenty of detail there. There is. The co-design final report from Marcia Langton and Tom Carmer lays out in a couple of hundred pages how The Voice would work or could work. The thing is, the government has not said, this is the model that we'll take forward. This is the model we'll put to Parliament. These are the details we support. They're happy to point to us and kind of hint that that's kind of what they're thinking, but they haven't actually said that that's the model we'll go with. So anyway, we'll see whether that shifts anytime soon. Let's move on. We've got a question from Joel, who asks, in the result of the Victorian election, when taken with the results of the federal election in May, is this a sign the Liberal Party is dead or dying as a political force in Australia? Have they simply been on the wrong side of social opinion on crucial issues, climate change, The Voice, same-sex marriage, refugees, for so long that they've rendered themselves unelectable? And is the New South Wales government headed for the same fate next year? That's a dire outlook for the Liberal Party. Yeah. Who wants to go first on that, David?
There's a lot in that question, Joel.
Yeah, look, the Liberals are conservatives, so they're instinctively against many of the sort of policies that were put forward in that question, many of the major progressive changes that you know have been put forward there. But yes, I think the Liberals are facing a serious identity crisis. Some think it's existential. They're losing votes, you know, to the centre, the Teals and the like, but they're also losing votes on the right. And we did see that in some seats in the Victorian election just last weekend. To sort of, you know, more extreme parties, if you like. They're stuck in the middle. And to this point, I think they've been leaning more to protect their right flank, both at a federal level and state level mostly as well, because I think they are a little perhaps captured by the Murdoch press and the commentators and the like, but to a much greater extent, I think it's their traditional base, which is sort of older conservative Australians. which is, you know, I might add, getting older, and their ranks are dwindling somewhat, you'd have to say. So look, they haven't, I think, done the work to find new voters, younger voters, for example, migrants in outer suburbs, migrant communities and millennials. But look, migrants, many migrants, and you know, this is a generalization, but a lot of migrants have conservative values. And you know, I'm not sure that enough work's been done to sort of to bring them into the tent. And yeah, you're right, the millennials and the kind of traditional Howard battlers, if you like, in the outer suburbs.
I think the generational question is a really big one for the Liberal Party. The Labor Party, at least, has been able to rely on its position more as a mass movement rather than the Liberal Party, which has always been drawn its party membership from a more limited base, and it is facing the consequences of its dwindling party membership. And the efforts that have been made to grow that base have been very targeted towards outcomes that might assist individuals in those parties, if I can put it that way. I don't think the Liberal Party is dead or even necessarily dying, but it very well could. And unless it finds a way to address its very narrow party base, that is not going to change, because at the moment it is not on the right side of those social progressive issues that it needs to be in order to get the next generation of voters on side. So to address that, it needs a broader base so that the candidates that they pre-select hold similar values to a broader swathe of the public, and therefore those elected or pre-selected members who then either become parliamentarians and help shape party policy in accordance with that. At the moment, it's a narrow party base, which means you're getting candidates from a very narrow field that then set the party policy that is drawn from that narrow position rather than the broader sweep of the society that it's seeking to represent. Now, the big question is, how do you broaden out a party base? And this is something that, you know, political parties are struggling with the world around. I mean, I think it's interesting to look to the UK, where, you know, there's been various efforts. We've seen the Conservatives in the UK try and really push for a more diverse targeting strategy for getting a diverse candidates up, which, you know, we can start to see results of in the UK in the Conservative Party. Maybe there's a role there. The UK Labour Party has tried, you know, $1 memberships in an effort to boost their membership numbers. I think the consensus is that didn't work very well in trying to get the public involved in their, you know, internal leadership votes as well. So I don't think there's a clear answer here, but it is something that's going to need to be addressed if the Liberals want to turn around that electoral direction that they're heading in.
Yeah, I think that's a great analysis from both of you. I wouldn't disagree with any of that. I think essentially, you know, it is that middle ground that we're seeing the Liberals lose too often, those teal seats we've all focused on. But don't forget, you know, and they're the wealthy electorates, Wentworth, Warringah, Goldstein, Kooyong. But they're also, they lost seats like Bennelong to Labor, or, you know, the Victorian election last weekend, a raft of seats in Melbourne's eastern and southeastern suburbs. This is the middle ground in politics. They're not winning. They're talking too much to their own base. It's this feedback loop that they've got to get out of. And Lippo, you touch on that as well. So, it's not easy, but it's interesting that Joel asks about those, you know, social issues, a lot of them. I do think politics is more dominated by those issues these days than the dry economic issues of 20, 30 years ago, where the Liberal Party, you know, finds its strength. So they need to find a way of positioning themselves on these social issues that cuts through. I mean, even on the dry economic issues, they've just lost this IR debate that we've just been through in the last 5 or 6 weeks as well. So they've got to find a better way of approaching those ones too. Question from Joe. As the parliamentary year wraps up, I'm interested in how the teal independents have behaved in relation to each other. Have they acted collaboratively, almost like an informal minor party, or have they done their own thing and kept to themselves? Mel, you're there in the building watching this closely. What's your answer to Joe's question?
Well, there's a couple of different answers to this, because there are certainly times when they have all worked closely together, and I think that's been to their benefit in order to secure outcomes. And also for ease of understanding, I think when we have particularly complex legislation around things like the Independent Anti-Corruption Commission, around industrial relations laws, when they're often seeking to achieve similar objectives, it has made sense and has worked well for them to work together. But I think it's certainly not an informal party, and that's not the uniform experience. There are some who are working really hard to keep a distinct identity from the others. I think if we look to Helen Haynes and Rebecca Sharkey, who were independents before this round of Teals came in, they are working very hard to make sure that they maintain a level of independence, a separate identity, which I think is somewhat about politics, but also about being able to leverage relationships they've already had established in this place. But I was having a chat to some other observers in the building yesterday, some MPs, who suggested that they're starting to see a little bit of tension at times amongst the Teals in the last few months. It might just be that they're getting a bit tired, because everyone in Parliament does, towards the end of the year. But I think there's also inevitably some tension where there's a competing desire for changes that might not be quite the same, or might like a bit of credit for the hard work that they've done in order to secure changes as well. One other extra thing that might be worth noting is that there's been a lot of pressure on David Pocock as the Senate independent for the ACT, and he has very much been striking out on his own. He talks and has discussions with other crossbenchers, both in the Senate and in the House, but is working as a solo unit. And that maybe that's not surprising, given the key position he holds as a deal breaker in the Senate.
David Pocock's been fascinating to watch in this IR debate. You know, he's come to this with a genuine open mind, I think. He hasn't engaged in, you know, the sort of stunts that sometimes you see the swing vote in the Senate engage in. He's just genuinely thought about this. He managed to actually get something through the whole process. That's this new expert body on government payments like JobSeeker and so on, providing advice to the government and everyone on what should happen with those. I mean, it's interesting the way he's done this in the end. Anyway, we've got a couple of questions I want to get to finally. One from Will. Why do all the MPs turn up to question time, even when they know they won't be asking or answering a question? Is it just because it's fun, easier than working in the office at a time of day when it can be hard to concentrate? Will says, do you think the behaviour at question time would be better if only the ministers turned up, the independents, and anyone who's been allocated by their party to ask a question? This is an interesting idea. It sounds a bit to me a bit like Senate estimates, maybe without the departmental officials, right? Just the ministers and the backbenchers asking them questions. Look, I wouldn't mind this. Maybe one day a week do it this way, Will's way. The reason, of course, they all turn up is convention, the fear of being criticised for not being there at the only time that anyone really watches Parliament. And worth remembering, for a time, Paul Keating didn't always turn up to every question time. He would turn up on designated days, and then other days would be left to other ministers to answer questions. That didn't last. PMs have, for a while now, been turning up every question time, and everyone does. But David, what do you think of Will's idea there?
Oh, look, I think it's worth considering. Anything's worth considering at the moment. I think the reason you go to part of it, but really it's because this is the part of Parliament that's televised. I mean, there's theatre in all of politics, but this is kind of the height of that theatre. And if you kind of had most of your backbench not there, a lot of empty seats, it doesn't look like you've got a lot of support. I mean, they're there as a cheer squad, a literal cheer squad, and I guess that's part of why it's turned into a bit of a Punch and Judy show, which no one really likes to watch.
And, you know, the extent that the parties go to create that theatre, I mean, then a lot of thought has gone into who sits on the benches directly behind the Prime Minister, in knowledge that they will then have high visibility. You know, at times where we've had criticisms of governments for not having enough senior females or enough females in their ranks altogether, what do you know, the few that they do have often end up bunched behind the Prime Minister in the seating plan. It's very, very coincidental. But I think we should point out here as well that a lot of MPs really like question time. Mm-hmm. A lot of them like the brawling and the theatre and the debating from it. So there are many that are very willing participants in this theatrical show, and the parties strategise around how to do this, and there's an expectation they'll turn up, and some of them are quite happy to do so.
The model I like is the British model, where, you know, you get PMQs, Prime Minister's questions, just once a week on a Wednesday. And on the other days when Parliament is sitting there, you actually have questions only on one portfolio to one minister. And I think it sort of takes a lot of the gotcha attempts, a lot of the Dorothy Dixes out of it, and you have a whole session of questions on one portfolio, and you know, you can really sort of dig a bit deeper. It's almost a bit like a mini estimates if you like, in Parliament.
It would also assist the public service and stop a lot of time wastage because at the moment all the ministers turned up prepped and ready with briefs in case they get asked about all manner of things, and they might get asked zero questions on that day. But nonetheless, their staff have had to go through the process of preparing for it. So the model you're suggesting, David, has a lot of positives there. But I think just in to answer to Will's, a couple of other parts of Will's questions, some MPs do bring work into question time. You'll often see them signing, you know, a big stack of documents or something to work through because they know they've got an hour to get through. I haven't seen it this year, but in past years, I've seen an MP bring in Christmas cards towards the end of the year and just sign off 100 of them during question time to get things done. So they, I guess they are cognizant of that.
Scott Morrison often looks very busy when he's being bagged by the other side. He's sitting up on the back bench. He's all very engrossed in whatever he's doing on his desk, working very hard, signing documents.
A lot of the crossbenchers in the Senate don't bother turning up to question time. They know they're not going to necessarily get a question, and a lot of them clearly can find better things to do with their time. So, Will, some MPs do make that decision.
A final question from Lee, which is on a similar theme. Lee says, if the children in school acted like the parliamentarians during question time, they'd be kicked out of class or suspended. Can we make a law that no person shall be interrupted while speaking? Look, Lee, I'm not sure I'm in any position to criticise interruptions. Sometimes as an interviewer, you've got to jump in there to bring someone back to the actual question. Maybe I'm more forgiving of interruptions in Parliament than others may be. I suspect if you just let politicians speak uninterrupted when they're asked a question, even if they're not being relevant, I'm not sure that would improve question time. Others may have a different view, though. What do you both think?
Look, I agree with you, you know, but I'd also love to see them, you know, sitting on like an Apple dunking machine and in Parliament. And if they say the wrong thing, the speaker presses a button and they fall into a big pot of freezing water.
I like it. This is the thing. It's hard with nuance, isn't it? Because there's times where interjections can be helpful, and it does stop the droning and the, you know, the blatant promotion that doesn't really answer questions. You know, interjections can be helpful sometimes to draw people to the point or to point out issues, but the level to which it gets is clearly ridiculous and doesn't set a good example. But how you get to that middle ground, I don't have a magic answer for that.
It's interesting that these concerns have not disappeared since the election. Maybe the tone of Parliament has improved, but there is still grounds for further improvement, I suspect. Look, we will have to leave it there. Big thanks to David and Mel. Great to pick your brains this week. Thank you for answering all these questions.
Thank you.
Great. Thanks.
And thanks to our producers. This is Matt Bevan, Sam Dunn and Robin Powell. That is our final pod for the year, so thanks for all your terrific questions. Hope you have a safe and happy break if you're getting one. We'll see you in 2023.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.